I was listening to that and thinking, oh, I think that's the Mavericks. And indeed, it's the Mavericks. And the band's lead singer, we learned, the singer and songwriter Raul Mallow, died on Monday. He was 60 years old. So we'll be playing the Mavericks music this morning as we come in our breaks. And we welcome you to the program. Good morning, everyone. Welcome. It is a Thursday morning. It's the 11th of December. We're delighted that you're here. And we thank you for spending time with us. I hope you just know how much it means to us that you do spend time with us and we get together and figure out what's going on in this great big world of ours. We welcome you to be a part of it. Anything you'd like to share with us, if you would like to share a comment or a question, we would love to include that in the program if we can. Panel@WAMC.org, panel@WAMC.org. And we'll get into that in just a few moments. Let me check in with our group here that is all in studio and ready to go. And I'm very excited because they're all dear friends and people that I greatly admire. So let's get started. Nick Rangel joins us, Executive Director of the Legal Aid Society of Northeastern New York. Good morning, Nick.
Good morning to you, and thanks for having me.
How you doing?
We're doing all right. Just to circle back on that earlier HUD story that I talked about a few weeks ago, the administration took back and canceled its notice of information, funding opportunity, the NOFO, which had all that language we were talking about that was really pretty terrible. So now things are in limbo, and we don't know what will be tied to HUD homelessness funding.
Well, we'll talk about some of this today, but there's a lot in limbo, isn't there?
There's so much in limbo,
and just not knowing even there's a ruling here and a ruling there, and you try to figure out what's in this is for now, and look over and what do you do? And that's I know a problem for so many agencies, and it seems like it's paralyzing in many ways.
It can be, and some organizations are preemptively acting because we all work on a reimbursement-based funding scheme. So we do the work first, and then we hope we get paid later. And so the more uncertainty there is, the harder it is to project those future revenues to keep people staffed. So it makes it really difficult to game that out, particularly past this next continuing resolution.
Well, thanks for the update and good luck as you move forward in this, I hate this word, but this journey. Judy Patrick joins us, former Vice President for Editorial Development at the New York Press Association. Good morning, Judy. How are you?
I am great. You know, I am thankful that Nick brought that issue to our attention, and I saw the update and I said, oh, problem solved, but apparently not. It was a real crisis in the making, and it wasn't something that was, you know, sexy enough to be at the top of the headlines every day. So I really appreciate her bringing that knowledge to our discussions every day.
Absolutely. Well, what we try to do, and thank you all for helping in that regard. My dear friend Ira Fussfeld is here, publisher emeritus of the Daily Freeman. Good morning, sir. How are you?
I'm pretty good, Joe. Good to see you and Judy and Nick, and glad to be here. And if I may indulge you, I'd like to add my condolences on the loss of Vera Carius Kelly. I enjoyed working with her on this program, and taken much too soon.
Yes, absolutely. And we're very much mourning the loss, tremendously sad, and as I said this earlier, but when we learn information about services and so forth, and what the family's asking for, we'll pass that information on. We don't have it. We don't have it yet. But thank you, Ira. Let's go to the news and start off with what is happening today. And as Ira told me, I was thinking about this driving in, but Ira actually articulated it when he walked into the studio, and he said, yeah, none of these topics are all that sexy. And he's right, but they're important, and we're going to get my God, we seized an oil tanker. That's exciting, isn't it?
Well, I want to hear more about this, because I'm of the belief that no matter what Trump says, I don't believe him. I mean, that's, to be serious, it's a problem when your leaders, your boss, your president is so constantly consistently lying about whatever he's talking about, that when he may be in a position to tell something that's literally the right thing, I anyway tend not to believe a word he says. If he came in here tomorrow and said tomorrow's Friday, I wouldn't believe him. So.
But you, the other thing too is, I mean, don't forget, Ira, this isn't just an oil tanker.
No, it's a big one.
This is a big oil tanker. It's a big old oil tanker.
Everything is one size large when he.
Well, yeah, seizure was a significant escalation.
But I mean, you know, you watch the video and you see these guys rappelling off of helicopters. I have to admit, this is where one of the things I don't know a lot about it is, where was the resistance? Was there nobody on this ship from Venezuela?
There was no resistance.
There was none.
No, and just for background, there was a subpoena for this particular ship that was issued by a U.S. judge because it had at some point been used to carry oil that was not supposed to be carried in that particular water because of sanctions. So the ship had been renamed, and they were – there's like some chatter about it like dodging – recognition by pinging its location off of different satellites.
And it had been off the radar for a while and came back and had been questionable.
Right.
But that's what I mean about not believing him. There seems to have been a legitimate reason and a legitimate authority for this to have happened. But coming on the heels of the boat explosions and myriad other things, my initial instinct with Trump is not to believe it.
Well, it's messy because the administration doesn't quite have all of its ducks in a row. It's got like a couple of them. So there may have been a legitimate reason. There might be a subpoena. But then nobody's been able to respond to like, and now what do you do with a big old giant tank, right? And nobody's answering any questions because I don't think they had a plan. It's like when you accidentally catch the Roadrunner, what do you do? I don't know. I don't think they know, actually.
Well, he said, I guess we'll take the oil.
Okay. Just a little background from the Washington Post. U.S. forces seized an oil tanker near the Venezuelan coastline Wednesday. A significant escalation in the U.S. pressure campaign against President Nicolas Maduro and his country's oil-dependent economy. Attorney General Pam Bondi said the U.S. Coast Guard, the FBI, and Homeland Security investigations executed a seizure warrant for a crude oil tanker used to transport oil from Venezuela and Iran in defiance of sanctions. The oil tanker had been sanctioned by the United States, quote, due to its involvement in an illicit oil shipping network supporting foreign terrorist organizations. That according to Pam Bondi, who wrote that on X Wednesday evening. She also shared a video that shows U.S. forces jumping out of helicopters and searching the large vessel on foot. Earlier Wednesday, Trump described the vessel as very large and the largest one ever seized, actually. And other things are happening, Trump said, speaking at a roundtable meeting of business leaders at the White House. So you'll be seeing that later, and you'll be talking about that later with some other people about the other things that are happening.
It's the other things that's really worrisome to me as well. I mean, my head was spinning thinking, are there narco-terrorists on this? We have the issues so confused. At this point, what really should happen in terms of messaging to the American public is the president would have an address and he would explain his policy and he would explain what happened and he would explain what happened next in coherent ways, but that's really not happening. And let's be clear that a video of the rappelling soldiers was released very quickly, as opposed to the video of the second tap, as we like to call it.
They got that up right away.
One video goes up one way, and the other one is withheld because of security concerns.
But you know that quote that Joe just read from Trump? Encapsulates the Trump presidency. This thing is going to happen today, and people are going to be talking about it, and tomorrow it'll be something else, and today will be largely forgotten. And this is what he does day after day. He programs the presidency.
I hope for that most days in the show that tomorrow this will all be forgotten. the name of the boat was Skipper, although I think on the
Skilligan's Island,
a Fipper. That's according to a U.S. official who spoke on the condition of anonymity. It was sanctioned in 2022 under an earlier name, the ADISA. The Treasury Department's Office of Federal Assets Control referred to the ownership at the time as Triton Navigation in the Marshall Islands. Triton was sanctioned with OFAC documents referencing a Swiss-based Ukrainian citizen who was also sanctioned at the time. OFAC described him as leader of a network of ships and illegal companies used to export Iranian oil for the benefit of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps and Hezbollah. So this is a complicated story. It is a it's one that has a lot of facets to it, and one of those facets, of course, is the of what this means for the stepping up of a campaign against Nicolas Maduro, a drug cartel leader and someone that that the president has identified as a bad guy, of what that means for the future of Maduro and his regime.
Well, I don't think there's any confirmation or evidence that Maduro is a drug cartel leader, more that there are people in his military that are involved with drug cartels, and that he hasn't done anything to curtail that. But not that even the military is a drug cartel, just that there's a people in the military who are themselves involved in drug cartels. So, that hasn't really been proven.
What is the Trump administration ultimate goal? What are we really trying to accomplish here? Regime change for what end?
For oil.
Yeah, I mean, there are a lot of other issues around the world that we could be concerned about as well. But, you know, the bottom line is the American public would rather the administration focus more on domestic issues than these international issues. I think, you know, seizing a big oil tanker, blowing up boats in the Caribbean, I think that distracts from other issues and makes Trump feel powerful and you know, takes the attention away from the troubling things that he would rather Americans not pay attention to.
But I do think, I mean, on that point, I think he's finding it more difficult to address the domestic issues than he had hoped. He's hitting barriers over and over and over again. But it's kind of swifter and more bombastic to do these sort of international diplomacy endeavors. I'm reading a book, Everyone Who Is Gone Is Here, and it's a anthology of U.S. intervention in Latin America and how it intersects with immigration and U.S. immigration policy. And Maduro is, you know, included in this book history, but so is Venezuela and El Salvador and Mexico. And it is really fascinating because of the moment that we're in, where Maduro at one point was kind of considered pretty heroic for most of the Chavez party, is now deploying like kill squads to keep his reign and stay in power after losing his election by like 40%. So it's a really complicated issue for the country.
You know, if we look back, I think that this can be backed up with facts, so I'll give it a shot. But most presidential candidates run for office on domestic issues, and just as Trump did and Make America Great Again, all that stuff. And then when they become president, they start getting involved peripherally with international incidents, and they find that not only is it important, but that they like it. It's I mean, I hate to describe it as fun, but it's like, well, what was the game? The Risk? Is that the one with geopolitics?
Yeah.
So they're now playing real live Risk, and it's enjoyable for them. And in Trump's case, his ego is such that he's stopping all these wars, allegedly, and he wants to do these things that are going to put a mark on his presidency that people will remember him forever. Well, I think he's already accomplished that, but I don't think it's on. I don't want to sound like I'm defending Trump, but I would point out that I think every president in my lifetime ran on domestic issues and became enamored of international issues.
The problem with the potential escalation is very real, though, here. This is used as an escalation. So what happens next, and how supportive is, you know, Congress of what we're doing here? How supportive is the American populace of what the administration is doing, especially if they escalate? I mean, there are many things they could do to escalate. And don't forget that Pete Hegseth is in charge of the Department of War. We're all fierce warriors now, and I think that's the attitude of this administration. Rather than, you know, rather than peace, it's more like we're asserting our control. We're the bullies in the hemisphere.
But that, I mean, I think that's why the defense bill that just passed out of the House and is going to the Senate and is probably going to pass the Senate is super interesting, because it repeals authorization that allowed us to invade Iraq and then engage in Kuwait and other Middle Eastern countries. It also limits the ability of the president to do what they're doing right now with bombing boats in the water for no reason. So it is interesting that the administration really does want us paying attention to what they're doing externally, because it has a bigger impact than what they can achieve domestically.
Right.
But I think it's also indicative that the people are not really interested in that, moving in that direction, and that there are fractures in the Republican Party that are also not interested in it.
We'll take a quick break, but when we come back, we'll talk about the House passing that Pentagon bill and the pressure they're putting on Pete Hegseth to release the boat strike evidence and what else is in that particular piece of legislation. Ira Fussfeld, Judy Patrick, and Nick Rangel with us on this Thursday morning. We welcome you, panel, at WAMC.org. We will continue after this news update.
But now my heart's breaking.
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Ira Fussfeld, Judy Patrick, and Nick Rangel with us. We, just as we were going out of, going into the break, we were talking about the House passing a Pentagon bill pressuring Pete Hegseth to release boat strike evidence. So the House on Wednesday, and Nick referred to this, approving a must-pass defense policy bill advancing lawmakers' efforts to force the release of a video showing the controversial military strike that killed two men who survived an initial attack on their alleged drug-smuggling vessel. The vote was 312 to 112. The Senate could pass the measure in the coming days. The lawmakers say they are confident President Trump will sign it into law. The legislation would withhold 25% of Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth's travel budget until he discloses all of his orders authorizing close to two dozen military attacks in September in the waters off Latin America, as well as releases unedited video of those operations, including the September 2nd strikes that killed 11 people, including the two men who survived the initial hit on their boat. Experts on the law of armed conflict, along with many Democrats and select Republicans, have questioned whether it was lawful for U.S. forces to target the boat again when the first strike failed to kill everyone on board. The GOP-led House and Senate Armed Services Committees opened probes into the operation shortly after the Washington Post reported many details of the attack 2 weeks ago. On Tuesday, Representative Mike Rogers of Alabama, who chairs the House panel, said he was satisfied with the information he had received from the Pentagon and planned to close his committee's inquiry. Nothing to see here. Still, spokespeople for the committee said the full panel would probably first have the opportunity to watch the full video of the strike and perhaps meet with the military officer who oversaw the operation, Admiral Frank Bradley. Rogers and other select lawmakers viewed the footage and spoke with Bradley last week. That from the Washington Post.
Well, explain to me what I'm missing something here. This is a bill that was passed that ultimately has to be signed into law by Trump, and they're confident that Trump will, in fact, sign it into law. Well, Trump is Hegseth's boss. Why can't Trump right now say, release this stuff, Pete? It's the dirt from this is spilling over to Trump. get it out there. It's going to have to. You're going to have to. You say you're going to sign the bill anyway. What? Why do they have to go to this length? I'm missing something.
Yeah, I don't understand. I agree as far as my confusion on that, because it just seems as though this is something that is continuing in the news. It's not going away, and so you've got the tape. You release it. We assume. I mean, even the president has said it looks really bad.
I mean, it's the same reason he forced Congress to put forward a bill to force him to release the Epstein files, which he had the authority to release prior to that legislation. I think in this case, the likelihood is that it's just one of the decorations on the Christmas tree of that $900 billion bill that, you know, was a sweetener for somebody to support that bill more vocally. I think what's more interesting, is it interesting that they're going to release that video? Yes, of course. Could they do it anytime? Also, yes. But the bill is super interesting because it is $900 billion. It, again, repeals massive levels of presidential authority and also Pentagon's authority and limits Hegseth's activities. But it also reforms procurement within the Pentagon, which has huge ethics implications that experts are very concerned about as far as, you know, self-dealing, speed to product line rollouts, and Hegseth's ability to decentralize decision-making on how they spend that money. I mean, it's a pretty tremendous bill. It's got, I think, big impact.
Right, and also includes a 4% pay increase for people who are in the military, an
service
important
members.
Yeah, service members. So that's an important part, and a lot of the provisions have bipartisan support. You know, and it's interesting to see where will this go. Washington Post has an interesting story today that talks about some of the context that went into the second bombing or the second attack on that ship. And it talks about how the admiral turned to a JAG officer and asked for some opinions about would it be okay for them to make another attack. And the rationale there was that the ultimate order was to destroy the boat, and that collateral damage is okay as long as it doesn't attack civilians or affect civilians. And the admiral is thinking, well, this is a enemy combatant. You know, the problem is the people in the boat, they didn't know who attacked them. They don't know that they are supposedly, you know, at war or enemy combatants with the United States. And so whether or not these people had radios and were calling for another vessel, all those arguments are clearly outlined in this article, and it comes to naught. And I think that the video itself looks very bad. The context that the administration is trying to offer to soften the impact of the video is not that convincing, at least from what I've read so far.
The other thing, too, is that initially it was, certainly in the early Washington Post reporting, that Hegseth was there and that had made the decision, and all that shifted, and what he said changed fairly dramatically. Then enter the admiral, and now it seems to be, in that story that you referenced in the Washington Post, it seems to indicate that by all accounts it was the admiral who made the decision as to the second strike, 30 minutes between the first and the second strike. And but you still have Hegseth, who is supporting the Admiral Bradley, but also trying to distance himself from the fallout. I don't know if that's possible or not.
You know, Hegseth made his mark on Fox News as a defender of military people in the military who had been brought up on charges for doing things that the military brass had thought violated military standards. So, I mean, he has a foundation in this neck of the woods, and I think his belief is, you know, you let the military do what they need to do. We put too many restrictions on them, and I think this is a classic example.
And who are we punishing by withholding 25% of his travel budget? Let's presume that the travel was necessary for fulfilling his...
That's a great question, Ira. Yeah. I was wondering that. Yes, I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, is he going to continue to do what he was going to do, but he'll have to sit and coach instead of in first class? I mean, I just don't, that's my theme today. I don't get it. I'm missing something. I'm just getting too old, and the world is driving me by. So.
From what I've read, a lot of the people in the administration are taking full advantage of the travel perks of being in office, from Cash Patel to, you know, a lot of them are, you know, using government equipment to, or government airplanes especially, to get where they want to go, to have their family get where they want to go. And they are not going to the airport and doing pull-ups before they hop on board or stand in line. Like all of the rest of us will
so
be doing.
So then what the Congress should be doing is saying, stop spending money on first class and fly coach like everybody else.
Well, they're not private jets.
They're private jets. Yeah.
They're not first class. These are private jets.
Vicky writes to us and says, this is all a pretext for a regime change to get Venezuela's oil. They can dress it up with all the buzzwords, sanctions, Iran, terrorism, etc. But it's all about the oil and it's all about the money. Diane writes, so it's always been about the oil. Trump doesn't care about drug running boats, which it's been said Venezuela is not doing. He doesn't care about the people of Venezuela or that President Maduro won't leave the office he lost in a fair election. I wouldn't be surprised if Trump is seeing this as an idea that he can use. But Venezuela has oil in the ground, and American corporations surely must have an interest in it. Those oil corporations have easy access to our own corrupt president. So, it seems to me, simple as that. That from Diane.
I think the president's said as much, actually, because he's had meetings with Maduro and also his opponent and tried to negotiate between the two of them, like, who would be the more likely to let to allow privatization of the oil sources and refinement centers. So... I don't think he's not hiding that.
Jonathan says the obvious elephant in the room is still being ignored. The drug war is a pretext and a distraction. The use of terrorism is a straw man argument. The administration has shown no interest in sharing relevant and important facts like names, drug evidence, or more importantly, the interrogations and prosecutions of survivors. Hegseth said in his recent speech that we are returning to gunboat diplomacy to enforce the Monroe Doctrine for the control of our hemisphere. Oil as a motive is the frosting on the cake being baked here. 19th century Fortress America is about the rise of empire and the fall of our republic. Trump is negotiating the betrayal of Europe with Putin in order to advance dominance in our hemisphere.
You know what we never talk about is drug treatment, helping people who are addicted to drugs deal with it, helping, encouraging people, you know, not to fall victim to drugs. I mean, this is, we never talk about that.
We never talk about the need of why the drug running is taking place in the first place, of why we have a market.
Right, and helping Americans who are struggling with this issue, help them. What happened to the flow of money into those kind of programs and services? I mean, they don't have press conferences about that.
No, they don't. That is true. We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. Real quick, this from Cynthia. We seem to have more than enough oil. We export it. We don't need more. What's the deal? This just smells like imperialism and ego. That's from Cynthia. Snuck that in before I change topics. We'll do exactly that right after this break.
Everybody knows you in the name.
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion on this Thursday morning, December 11th. And we welcome you to the program and to the proceedings. And we thank you for being here as always. So let's talk about other stuff, things that are going on. and things that we want to make mention of before our top of the hour break. Of course, the other big story is ACA subsidies, and we've been talking about this on and off all week, and I'm sure we'll continue to until there's some resolution or whatever that looks like. I assume there won't be really a resolution, but here we go. Lawmakers are now launching a bipartisan last-minute bid to force a vote on ACA subsidies. Two bipartisan groups of House lawmakers launched last-minute bids Wednesday to force votes on extending the Enhanced Affordable Care Act subsidies set to expire at the end of the year. The efforts, both using a legislative tool known as a discharge petition, face long-shot odds. At least 218 members of the House would have to agree to consider the bills first, including most House Democrats. If either succeeded in the House, it would need to get at least 13 Republican votes in the Senate. If all of the chambers, the Democrats, supported it, if all the Democrats in the chamber supported it. But the attempts may present the best chance remaining for lawmakers to push through an extension for the enhanced ACA tax credits that expire at the end of the year, increasing health insurance costs for most of the 24 million Americans who get coverage from the Obamacare marketplace. Most Republicans oppose extending the credits, which were put in place by Democrats during the COVID-19 pandemic. The GOP argues that the subsidies are outdated, push up the price of health care, and are vulnerable to fraud. Democrats have argued that the credits are key to keeping health care affordable for people on the ACA marketplace, and they insisted on the extension through the recent government shutdown. The party is pushing legislation to extend the credits for 3 years without other changes, but that effort is expected to fail in a Senate vote on Thursday, otherwise known as today. Nick.
I mean, I think this is interesting because in some areas we see some, I would say, some weakening or less than strong relations between the House and the president. But in this instance, the House is really moving towards letting them expire at the direction of the president, even at the risk of losing marginal seats and even in some really deeply red areas. So I think this is going to hurt a lot of people, but I do think it's going to have pretty tremendous impact on the midterms.
Oh, yeah. The political consequences are going to be, I would think, devastating to the Republicans who are holding firm on this. I would be stunned if they come up with an agreement today or next week because they seem so divided. My understanding is the Republicans can't even come together on a plan. They have three different ideas. One of them would be like to create these health savings accounts and let people shop for themselves. Have you ever tried to figure out your health insurance? You know, it is so confusing. It is trying to figure out what's covered, what doctor you can go to see, what prescriptions are covered. It is mind-numbing, and it is far out beyond the reach of most people. The bottom line is, health insurance is a problem for us all. I mean, Heather Mulligan was here the other day and she was talking about small businesses. Their biggest concern is the cost of health insurance for their employees. It's expensive for all of us around this table. The ACA deals with the most vulnerable people, and I think that's a good start, but I see no political upside for the Republicans on this one.
Yeah, I just don't understand why they are not acting, because this was the big bone of contention during the government shutdown, and ultimately the Democrats let the bill go through without what they wanted. But we're back to that argument again, and people are going to start getting their bills and see how significant they're going up. And I can't imagine that they're not going to be pressuring every congressman and senator that they can find in the street, because the public is not going to stand for it.
A lot of people, from the interviews I've heard, the man on the street stuff that some of the media outlets are doing, people are saying, well, I'm just going to go without insurance. And so the impact of that is going to be disastrous, especially for hospitals who will have to treat people even without insurance, because if they're on the verge of death, if they come up with a chronic disease, they're going to be even in worse shape. So people are saying, no, I'm not going to pay $26,000 a year. I'll just wing it, like a lot of people do already.
Right. Yeah. And that does seem to be when people are, when you ask them what their options are of where they're going to go, they'll just say, I'll have to do without it because I can't afford it otherwise.
That's what they were doing before.
Sure.
ACA expansion. So I'm just looking up these stats. Over 3/4 of all Americans who rely on those particular tax credits live in states that voted for Trump in the 2024 election. Some of the highest, deepest red states, Texas, Florida, Georgia, North Carolina, where in Florida, at least 20% of the population is enrolled in these marketplace plans. I mean, that's a tremendous number of people who live in states that won't be able to subsidize marketplace tax credits themselves, and also will completely lose access to what little health care they already have little access to. I mean, there are parts of Texas that, you know, don't have have only a doctor or a chiropractor who acts as a doctor in like entire regions. So I just can't imagine how terrible this can be for a lot of people. I'll just say, as a nonprofit, our health insurance company started out with a 25% increased demand on us for the coming year, with at that point 3 months' notice. We had to negotiate that down to still a high increase. I think it was 15%, but that's been 15% increase for employer coverage every year for the last 3 years. And that kind of increase at the marketplace for individuals is unsustainable.
And there's still the quality of the care that you're getting as a result of that insurance, too. I mean, that's the other thing. You're still dealing with the system that you have, which is also broken.
Yeah, I mean, it's not just the cost of the premiums. As Judy says, it's impossible to figure out what these plans say sometimes. But I know in my case, now I'm on a Medicare Advantage plan. The premium is going up $20 a month, which doesn't sound like a huge amount, and I can afford it. But who knows how many places within the context of the coverage is or doesn't allow is also going up, and you don't feel that until down the road.
And don't forget that Medicaid restrictions kick in, was it next year? And they are already having an impact, especially in rural areas where hospitals are saying, we're going to have to shut down. So when you don't have any insurance and you need to go to a hospital because you broke your leg, you're going to have to travel farther to do it, especially if you don't have any health insurance coverage. It is a mess. It's something, you know, that we look to the government to try to solve, because the marketplace has not been doing it for us. Anybody who's ever gotten one of those explanation of benefits of things in the mail, look at it, is this a bill?
Do I pay this? Do I not?
When are they going to explain it to me?
So, and I've talked a little bit about this. I had a medical bankruptcy about 15 years ago. I had a massive spinal surgery, and then I was hospitalized with basically my lungs couldn't recover for the from the surgery because I was under for too long. Anyway, I blew through all of my insurance coverage, and then walked out after insurance covered what it would cover because of the ICU care, had a $200,000 debt at 28 years old, right? And then, because my insurance was so poor at that time, because I was 28 years old, I couldn't cover the physical therapy that was required to get back on my feet and like go back to the workplace. I actually found this really wonderful person who traded physical therapy for office work, and it worked out okay. But that's not possible for most people. And I do think that the long-term impact of increasing healthcare rates so much that people lose their coverage is that, one, people will not get treated for things that will take them out of the workforce, but also could potentially impact other people, could be spreadable diseases, it could be sexually transmitted diseases, all these things. You're going to have people not accessing the kind of prenatal care that they should have or reproductive health care that they should have access to. And then you're also going to have people who just, they go to the hospital, they walk out with a giant bill. Hospitals do have some forgiveness, but it is, there's a cap on how many dollars they can set aside. It's funded by states, and states have to make that decision through their budget process and kind of say, this is how much we can forgive in this debt. Otherwise, you get that bill. And medical bankruptcy is like the only kind of bankruptcy that really is achievable for an individual in most cases anymore. So you just see this huge increase in bankruptcies.
Because there, I mean, there's no other option.
Because right? There's no other options, right?
Yeah.
And this is the richest country in the world, and there are many other countries that are doing it differently and better, and we are stubbornly plodding along in this disastrous time.
Yeah, people won't get cancer screenings. They won't do the kind of preventative care because it's expensive. They'll go without it. They'll risk it. And the consequences will be devastating for many people.
Well, and it's the rural hospitals that close first, right?
Right.
Well, right. And that's, yeah. And, well, it is, but you also see all the, with you just see what's happening in Albany with the hospitals, with the system we have, and how difficult that is to keep that going. And you think, well, okay. So then you extrapolate that out to rural areas. I mean, they don't have a chance really. And that's keeps showing itself over and over again, I think.
Yeah, it's interesting how there's like an intersection too with people who are on, you know, Medicaid or ACA. Marketplace coverage, there are a lot of just private practitioners where the majority or a large share of their total revenue are from that population, and it helps supports their entire business. And if those people walk away, the rest of their client, their patients aren't going to be able to fill that revenue gap that they lose when people stop going to the doctor.
We'll take a break. We'll continue our conversation on the roundtable on this Thursday morning after this. Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Ira Fussfeld is here, publisher emeritus of the Daily Freeman. Judy Patrick is former vice president for editorial development of the New York Press Association, and executive director of the Legal Aid Society of Northeastern New York, Nick Rangel, joins us as well. We welcome your letters, as always, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. A couple of letters regarding health care and health insurance, and then we'll move on to other topics, I promise. Sam said, when it comes to health care, I think the panel is falling into the trap of trying to logic out an ideological issue. Most of the people staunchly against state-funded health care find it easier to imagine dying from preventable illness than allowing the government to do something that is in everyone's best interest. It's not rational, compassionate, or self-preserving. It is serving a higher need than that, protecting their own egos. That from Sam. Lisa checks in. Think regular insurance is complicated? Medicare is crazy compilation of Advantage, Medigap, and traditional Medicare. Comparing them is impossible. And prices for Advantage go up yearly, and benefits are chipped away.
You were talking I've had a very good experience with it, generally speaking. I actually think the rates went down 1 year, which is the monthly premium. But you won't get any argument from me about the whole arena being confusing and hard to sort through.
We go to Barbara. How about we get the insurance that our congresspeople and our president get? You know, the insurance that we pay for.
I will say my insurance in the Senate was the best insurance on the planet. It was very good.
Yeah. Mike says, to borrow a tired GOP phrase, what is needed is the decommodification of American healthcare through the repeal and replacement of the ACA. The fundamental problem of the ACA is that it abandoned any modicum of decommodification in favor of subsidizing private insurance companies through the establishment of healthcare exchanges. Remember that it was upheld by a conservative Supreme Court based on the government imperative to tax, not to provide care to citizens. Repeal, replace, restore, says Mike. Then we go to Peter. The way to get Congress to pass meaningful health care reform is to take away their health care. Let them buy their own. See what happens. That from Peter. Then we go to Eddie. Medicare will also become more expensive starting next year. Medicare went up $185 to $202.90 in 2026. All right. Finally, we go to, maybe not finally, but we go to John. To understand this administration in a nutshell, read about the State Department's order to switch from the Calibri font to Times New Roman. The wrong decision made for the wrong reasons and then made into a big deal to distract from the big picture. This was a story. It was covered both in the Times and in the Washington Post and elsewhere. I guess this came out of Marco Rubio's office, correct? Of a decision that the font that had been used, the change from Times New Roman to Calibri during the Biden administration, was being changed back to Times New Roman because they found the Calibri font to be too woke.
Yeah, what does that mean?
I have no idea.
I don't know.
Because easier to read if you are dyslexic. That particular font is considered a better font for people with dyslexia. I use that font. It is easier to read. And I think because the administration had such a hard time identifying or defining what DEI is, these departments go in and they try to find something that like smells of DEI, which is just inclusion, right? It's just like what allows this person to do their job effectively. It is a font that is easier for them to read. And now they're trying to say, see, this is what DEI is. Who are we trying to solve for? Why should we change what we do in order to keep people who are dyslexic employed? Actually, the Pentagon bill includes provisions that dismantles a program that hires people with disabilities for similar reasons, I think.
I love it when fonts make the news. Newspaper people, we love fonts.
Well, we're supposed to talk about this on the media project. Yeah, so it's been a late addition to our list.
And, you know, Calibri is the
rehearsal.
It's the default for Microsoft products. So it's been out there forever. I mean, fonts, people in the news, every newspaper, you know, makes a big deal picking its font, you know, for the print edition, and they take great pride in it. There's even a whole documentary on the Helvetica font.
Yes, yeah.
Lovely, great. It talks about, you know, the importance, how valuable the selection of a particular font can be. But yeah, again, it's ridiculous for Rubio to make this change. I think they just went through and say, what did Blinken change? Everything Blinken changed. Blinken, the former Secretary of State.
Yeah.
We're going to change everything back.
I have this edition. It's one of my favorite novels of all time is Great Expectations. And I have this fantastic edition of Great Expectations that in the back goes through all of the various fonts that were used over the years for the printing of the official printing of the novel. And what they do there, which I love, is because many times in the back of a novel or a book, they will tell you about the printing and about the font. That this tells you not only that information, but why it was used, and then give examples so you can see the difference of it. And it's just fascinating, endlessly fascinating.
I'm a big Helvetica fan. Helvetica Bold, to be precise.
Yes. Well, we all have our favorites, yes. Really. Yes. All right. Let's go to thank you for bringing up fonts. That was good.
You're a font of information.
Yes, that's good stuff. All right. Let's move on to other topics. Making our list of stories this morning. And we begin, or we don't begin, but we continue with million-dollar visas. The Trump administration has opened the application process for million-dollar visas. President Trump has framed the program as a way to for the federal government to raise billions of dollars and prioritize admission of successful entrepreneurs and investors. It is the Trump Gold Card. The United States of America is what it says on the back. There is a small image of the Statue of Liberty to the left, and then leering over the shoulder of the Statue of Liberty is the face of Donald Trump. I believe the same image used in the mugshot, and I'm not making that up. And then to the right, in with stars and stripes around, says Trump Gold Card. This is a expedited visa that the federal government plans to provide to people who pay at least $1 million. To apply for the card, people have to pay the non-refundable $15,000 processing fee, according to the site. I just want to say, I was, before the show today, in this group, I was complaining about the $30 for my enhanced license. So I just, there's that. But to apply for the card, people have to pay a non-refundable $15,000 processing fee, according to the site. After applicants are vetted and approved by the Department of Homeland Security, they will then have to pay $1 million to receive U.S. residency in record time, quote unquote, and become lawful permanent residents. A $1 million gift upon completion of the individual's vetting is evidence that the individual will substantially benefit the United States, the website says. An individual may also need to pay small additional fees to the U.S. Department of State, depending on his or her circumstances. The website also provided a depiction of the card, which features a portrait of President Trump against the backdrop of an American flag and his signature under the words Trump Gold Card.
People are, for if you have enough money, you can skip the line. It's as simple as that, and it's shouting to the world that we don't want people who may have great potential to make America great. We only want people who are already established, rich people. My grandfather, my relatives would never have been able to come to America under these provisions. You know, you go to the back of the line. It's so wrong. The only benefit from the reading of the news on this is that it would generate income. There's so many wrong things about this that I can't believe that we're that it's a real thing. I can't believe this isn't another one of those onion headlines. It's just wrong.
Well, it comes off that way, and it's hard to believe. And then you see the card, and you do think it's an onion headline, and it's not. And but like many programs and many things in the past that Trump has flouted, you know, will it actually see the light of day? And we don't know that yet.
I think so. What's interesting is that this program, I think there's a couple of interesting things. One is that it demonstrates that, in fact, the president can make real substantive actions on immigration and people immigrating through executive order and does not need to rely on Congress to do something about preserving the dignity of the people who have been in the U.S. for many decades now and who, under other presidents, might have enjoyed amnesty. Anyway, so I think it's interesting that he was able to do a thing with executive order. And the thing here is a visa. This visa replaces the EB-5 visa, which is an immigrant investor program offering permanent residency for foreign individuals investing significant capital in the U.S. businesses that create or preserve at least 10 jobs to stimulate the economy. The requirements of that visa include a minimum investment of $800,000 in targeted employment areas or rural areas, so areas that need real investment that it's not getting otherwise, or $1,500,000 anywhere else in the United States. As long as it's a lawful capital source and it creates those jobs. So this, the concept of buying a visa exists. We're already allowing that. What we're doing differently is we're putting it in our general fund instead of in a for-profit business model in a particular region or rural area. So it's going into the general fund instead of into some private investment, which I'm not entirely opposed to, really.
Isn't there a very real possibility, however, that if allowed to continue and if it gains traction, and all of these things are questions, I don't know whether that will be the case or not, but if they gain traction, and by the way, act now and there's more, because there's also a platinum membership for $5 million. That hasn't been set yet, but you can get on the waiting list for that. And then there's the platinum membership. So don't settle for gold if you can go for platinum. But doesn't that then, if this takes root and this works, then allow the traditional system to become a husk and put aside, because it is not the, quote, moneymaker that this program was?
I mean, this administration's already substantially cut the number of refugee and asylum visas it allows, and really gutted that program entirely. We know that they have a real interest in reducing immigration, legal or without documents, from countries that Trump calls obscenities. I think they're kind of happening simultaneously, but it's not as if all those people are suddenly going to have access to these other visas. Again, that program really does already exist. So it's not really replacing anything. It's just putting that money into the general fund for...
Are they predicting how many people are going to take advantage of this? Do they have... You know, we were talking earlier about there never seems to be a follow-up plan. All right, this thing is out there. Is it going to be worth the time and effort, or are there going to be six rogue billionaires who are willing to spend this kind of money, and that'll be it?
Right. Where's the research that says there's a need for this program,
yeah,
for our government to spend the time and resources to develop it? And what's to say? I know they say that the people will be vetted by the Department of Homeland Security. Well, what's to say that they're actually going to do a thorough job of vetting them and maybe not look the other way if someone more suspect than usual? I mean, it just goes against the whole notion of America as a land of opportunity. I mean, people who can afford to pay $1 million, they already have opportunity. We want to provide opportunity for people who may not have money, who may not have resources, and they can come here and help us build a better nation.
So the current interest, Ira, is actually shocking to me. The official website for the Trump card had a wait list of 70,000 registrants.
Wow.
Within hours of a morning update. The Commerce Department initially expected to issue tens of thousands of the cards, but will start with an initial 80,000 available cards. So there are 80,000 people who can pay $1 million for a fast track to permanent residency in the United States.
And my understanding, this is businesses included, so it's not only individual but corporate.
I don't know that.
There is a corporate provision.
Yeah.
It's another, 2 million for corporations.
Yeah. So
already can buy this now for less than $1 million today?
Right. Don't tell them that. In the past weeks, the Trump administration has made sweeping changes to the legal immigration system. This is from the New York Times. Federal officials put a hold on immigration applications filed by nationals from 19 countries subject to the president's travel ban, which are mostly in Africa and the Middle East. They have also paused decisions on asylum applications and promised to review the more than 50,000 asylum applications that were approved during the Biden administration. Those changes come after the shooting of two National Guard members in Washington last month. Trump administration officials have cited the shooting to justify the reforms, saying they are necessary to increase the vetting of immigrants in the country, unless you have the cash. Right?
Yeah, you know, the asylum seeker issue is complicated because people who are seeking asylum can largely just live in the United States while they're waiting, and the backlog causes years of waiting. Asylum cases can often take 3+ years before they can be heard, and a tremendous amount of document review, and it's just, they're really complicated cases. And so if you're an administration that fundamentally opposes the notion that people could be in the U.S. without a legal status yet pending application, they're going to, you know, obviously take issue with how that is not functioning, or how dysfunctional that system is from their perspective.
The bottom line message is we just want rich, educated people to come to our country. We don't want people who don't have the money, who don't have the wherewithal. I mean, you hear it so often from people that, you know, immigrants are just coming to the country to live off the, you know, the public dole. I mean, it's just part of underscoring their basic approach to immigration. Rather than us do comprehensive immigration reform where we talk about the, you know, the judicial system that processes these cases, or the administrative network that is there to help people who are seeking entry into our country. Rather than do that, we're he's tweaking the system at the upper end to the advantage of rich people who don't need access.
I think that it's actually more in alignment with the rise of nationalism and replacement theory in the MAGA movement than it is about wanting more rich people and not other people. I think it has a racial undertone and a religious undertone. And I think, you know, by preferencing countries that are producing white people who might come here, and then banning countries that are not producing white people for this administration's purpose, is sort of supporting the notion that immigration itself isn't necessarily bad, but replacement of this, you know, MAGA identity is the problem, right?
We have a couple letters, and then we'll get to some more on the other side of the break. Deborah says, really, he's turning our country into a giant casino in so many ways. Unfortunately, he tanked his previous casino, so we'll see what happens there. The gold card, does the gold card come with anti-deportation insurance, is what Jonathan wants to know. Good morning. Trump's gold card sums up his MO precisely. It's always paid pay to play. That from Anthony. Then we go to John, who says, new Statue of Liberty inscription, give me your tired, your rich, your huddled masses yearning to breathe autocratic air. That from John. And then we go to Timothy. Hello, panel. You're all wonderful. The $1 million visa is designed to allow international Bitcoin grifters and their ilk to enter the United States and hide. If you look at this, that is exactly what it is calling out to do. I hope you have a lovely day. Well, thank you. We will now. I appreciate it, Timothy. We'll take a break. We will come back. We'll finish up on the return right after the short break. Well, it's hard to cut that off, isn't it? That's great. It'd make you feel happy to be alive. Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. We have just about 20 minutes left with this terrific group. Let me reintroduce them to you. Ira Fussfeld is here. Judy Patrick joins us, as does Nick Rangel. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org. You write to us, panel at WAMC.org. Keep your letter short and to the point, and hopefully we can include it in the discussion we have moving forward. More topics to discuss, and we will get to them, although we're making very good time today. It seems like we have the tailwinds with us. The Fed has cut rates again, but deep divisions cloud the path ahead. I will preface this conversation by saying our economist Aaron Pasitti will be with us tomorrow with three of his students from Siena University, and we'll be discussing this topic at length. So if any of you feel you want to yield to the economist, certainly that is fine. But as far, I did want to mention it considering the nature of the story. But the central bank's decision to lower interest rates for a third straight meeting was highly contentious, reflecting an internal divide that will likely limit how much borrowing costs will fall next year. The Federal Reserve lowered interest rates by a quarter of a percentage point on Wednesday. The split among policymakers suggested that the central bank may be done lowering borrowing costs for the time being unless there are clear signs that the labor market is weakening further. The decision to cut for a third meeting in a row shifted interest rates to a new range of 3.5 to 3.75%. It marked the fourth straight vote that was not backed by all members of the 12-person Federal Open Market Committee, underscoring how fractured the central bank has become as it grapples with the risk of both rising unemployment and sticky inflation.
And the problem here for them at this point, one of the issues is, despite including the political pressure, also is the fact that they don't have all the data that they typically do, in part because the Bureau of Labor Statistics isn't releasing them anymore, or in part because of the shutdown meant that people didn't have time to do the kind of reporting that needs to be done. So they were, in some respects, operating in a vacuum. I think they made it clear, though, that one of the reasons that inflation is sticking around or maybe rising a bit is the tariff issue. And I think that will come home to roost for the American buying public in the new year. And I think the Fed is concerned about that.
Yeah, and I would give a lot of credit to Powell, who has withstood the pressure that must have been horrible that Trump applied to him. And he's held his ground. And the board, the Fed board, seems to be more politicized than it was in the past. And Powell, in the face of, is going to be replaced. They're already interviewing his replacement candidates. But he is a true public servant who wants to act independently.
Well, I just read in that article that the 12-person Federal Open Market Committee from the New York Times that I was reading from, it underscores how fractured it has become as it grapples with the risk of both rising unemployment and sticky inflation. And certainly those are issues. But also, it has to be fractured just because of what's going on with the president and Powell and the back and forth and the attacks. And that can't have a positive impact on the overall board.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the administration just doesn't have a lot of credibility with Powell, and he kind of says that, right? He says, speaking at a post-meeting news conference, Powell said Fed staff believe the government may be overstating monthly job creation by as much as 60,000 jobs, given that published data shows the economy adding roughly 40,000 jobs a month since spring. Powell's statement means the real number could plausibly be negative to the tune of 20,000 job decline per month. You know, he's explicitly saying that the federal government is lying to the public about job creation and job growth, and that his Fed staff don't find government data reliable or credible and have made this decision and its argument for this decision based on its own research. And I think that's tremendous.
I mean, you have to wonder, how low does President Trump want this interest rate to go? Or does he want 1% interest rate? And from where I stand, if the interest rates go so low, I can see it encouraging an explosion of home buying. But what we'll see in part of that is an increasing rise in home prices. I mean, I think low interest rates in some respects doesn't lower prices. It increases the demand and will. I mean, I'm no economist, but that's where I see it headed.
Anybody else on that? I want to, there's a story that is breaking as we are on the air and is, I hear phones buzzing. Actually.
I know.
a federal judge in Maryland ordered the immediate release of Kilmar Abrego Garcia from Immigration and Customs Enforcement custody, saying Department of Justice attorneys, quote, misled the court at a hearing last month. The U.S. District Judge Paula Innes said that she ordered his release in part to ensure that he had a fair immigration process after the Justice Department and an ICE witness last month said immigration officers had no other option but to deport him to the African nation of Liberia because the Central American country of Costa Rica no longer was willing to offer Abrego refuge. The judge cited reporting by the Washington Post and ABC News that found that Costa Rica had, quote, never wavered in its commitment to accept the deportation of Abrego. She was also the judge who first ordered the Trump administration to facilitate the return of Abrego to the United States after immigration officers illegally deported him to a notorious prison in his native El Salvador. Since Abrego's return from wrongful detention in El Salvador, he has been re-detained again without lawful authority, that from Innes, from the judge. For this reason, the court will grant Abrego Garcia's petition for immediate release from ICE custody. The story is developing. It will be updated. There will be more to come. But as of now, that is what we have. I'm unclear as to exactly where he is right now. Is it Liberia?
I don't think he's in Liberia. I'm just guessing. I do not know. The attorneys who are dealing with these cases must be working overtime. And this is just one of these cases. It's not, this is one that got our attention because of the, dramatic attention when he was first detained. But it's so complex and so in need of lawyers specializing in immigration law. It's like this is the courts have got to be jam packed with cases dealing with this. It's a I can imagine that the Department of Justice is going to appeal this and he will be back in custody. For now, from what I'm seeing on TV, it seems like he is an immediate, he will be immediately released.
Well, I think we ought to start a GoFundMe page and help him get one of the $1 million visas.
There you go.
Get him right in there.
Good
idea.
A gold card.
Yeah, get a gold card. And this is an interesting story because it does, this captured a lot of people's attention because it just seems so clear that this was a person who just got swept up in a system that didn't make sense.
But as the reporting from all over the country is indicating, this is happening, dozens if not hundreds of times where people are getting swept up or disappeared and we don't know where they are. And, the local news ecosystem is down, is lower than it used to be. So we don't even have local reporters a lot of times to track these cases. So as Americans, we really need to ask for accountability from the Department of Homeland Security and ICE about what they're doing with people they arrest and to make sure that they're getting, the due process that the Constitution calls for.
Yeah, so I guess so. He was forced to be moved from Pennsylvania back to Maryland. Then he is currently being held in Maryland, and he's going to be released to home with electronic monitoring as part of his pretrial conditions for an ongoing criminal case. Part of what is kind of interesting about Kilmar Garcia is that as an immigrant from El Salvador, it has started to shed some light on the conditions in El Salvador in a way that people have been kind of turning away from for decades. The involvement the U.S. has had in the governance of El Salvador and the support it had of really you know, extreme brutality through its civil war and then transition. I mean, the like MS-13 actually took roots in the U.S. first, and then was brought to El Salvador through deportation processes, where it and many other gangs had an opportunity to flourish because it, as a country, didn't have the resources to combat gangs and gang violence. And so here is an individual who has migrated here, potentially for economic reasons, but many people leave El Salvador because of the gang violence and because of their protected characteristics being targeted. And this guy's like fighting for his life to stay in the United States, and now we're going to try to send him to Africa. I mean,
I think it's stunning. There's going to come a time, it may not be in the next few years, who knows when, but the conditions under which these people are apparently living, it boggles the mind. And I don't know how that is avoided. The whole process stinks.
There was just a story, I think, in the New York Times about the prison conditions where our government was sending deportees in El Salvador, a prison that we're paying to hold these people, and which, because of our subsidies of El Salvador's military governance, has received billions of dollars from the United States to create the model that they are using for this prison system. And the conditions being so horrific and so severe that they can only be described as beyond human rights abuses, but real torture. And that is the kind of experience that Kilmer's trying to avoid by staying in the U.S. And we're allowing this administration to keep sending people to these like
I don't remember which story it was, and I think it was El Salvador where they described the prison as the notorious prison. And right. You got a prison when the word associated with the word notorious, you know something's not good.
Yeah.
Well, certainly, obviously, follow the story and much more information to come on it as it is breaking. Right now, and information still coming in. Speaking of breaks, we're going to take a break. We're going to say goodbye to Nick, who has to run to a meeting. But we thank you very much for being with us. Have a beautiful holiday if I don't see you. Otherwise, are you back next week?
Yeah, I think I am.
Oh, great. Okay, yeah. Well, good. We'll talk then.
Okay, cool.
We'll be back with more of the Roundtable panel right after this. All right. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to the panel discussion this morning. Left in the room, we have Ira Fussfeld and Judy Patrick. They're getting ready to do the media project. I think a bunch of media types in a room getting ready to do the media project. What better thing to do than talk about a media story and about CNN and where they stand right now? This is a confusing, big, ugly story. But here we go. President Donald Trump said Wednesday that he thinks it is imperative that CNN is sold as its parent company, Warner Brothers Discovery, gears up for a proposed merger with Netflix and faces a hostile takeover bid from Paramount. Who we should mention, funding is coming from the president's son-in-law. Okay. Donald Trump, I think, quote, I think CNN should be sold because I think the people that are running CNN right now are either corrupt or incompetent, Trump told reporters during a roundtable with business executives at the White House. I don't think they should be entrusted with running CNN any longer, so I think any deal should be guaranteed and certain that CNN is part of it or sold separately, he added. I think CNN should be sold along with everything else. Trump was responding to a question about changes he would like to see to the cable news network after the Wall Street Journal reported Monday, citing people familiar with the matter, that Paramount CEO David Ellison visited Trump in Washington and said he would make significant changes to CNN. The White House did not immediately respond to requests for comment on that Wednesday. I will probably be involved, maybe involved, probably maybe involved in the decision, the president says. It depends. You have some good companies bidding on it, Trump said at the White House before he launched into a broader criticism of CNN's leadership. Warner Brothers Discovery said last week that it had agreed to sell its movie, television, and streaming assets to Netflix in a $72 billion deal, which would rise to more than $82 billion when debt is factored in, following bids from Paramount, Skydance, and Comcast, which owns NBC Universal, the parent company of NBC News. The Netflix deal would not include cable channels owned by Warner Brothers Discovery, such as CNN and TNT. They would be taken over by another corporation. CNN, Paramount, Warner Brothers Discovery, and Netflix did not immediately respond to requests for comment on the remarks by the president.
I have some advice for the president. You should not be involved in this.
Yes, stay away.
Stay away. It's none of your business. You're polluting the whole deal. And, you know, one of the things to consider here is the fact that this is a huge deal with really major implications. CNN is a small part of this. But if you would listen to the president, you would think this was the major cog in this whole machine. It's a small issue. The idea... I'm sure he is salivating at the idea that he can dictate, you know, he can tell Wolf Blitzer or Caitlin Collins or any of the people that he thinks do him wrong, he can show them the door. And that's not how the media is supposed to operate. I understand that, you know, media companies are, especially in the private sector, are privately owned and the owners can do as they choose. But in this case, the media owners are trying to get approval for their deal or to shore up and their standing and their bid to do this, you know, this takeover by getting signs from the president that he will approve his administration will approve the deal more quickly than the competing Netflix deal, which does not include CNN. It's just so dangerous, so wrong. He needs to stay out of it. And I can't believe that he's just outright coming out and saying, I probably will be involved in it. He shouldn't.
Well, it just adds another subject to the long list of things he shouldn't be involved with. This is such a, as Joe pointed out, this is such a significant deal for so many different reasons, one of which that I would highlight is the purchase of by Netflix of Warner Brothers and the addition of all of the Warner Brothers content is going to be another step towards the death of movie theaters. People are not already, to a lesser degree, going to theaters to see movies when they know they're going to show up streaming in the comfort of your own home. And Netflix is saying that it will continue to use theaters and then transition these movies to streaming, but their history says opposite that. And again, this is just a much greater piece financially and socially than just simply talking about the CNN component.
Right, and it deals with how many feature-length movies will be made going forward, whether or not we're just going to get flooded with more reality shows, which are cheaper to produce. I mean, that there's, you know, Warner Brothers has the Paramount has a case to be made that they would do a better job of stewarding, you know, Warner's going forward. But the CNN piece just makes that whole pitch stink.
Well, and the fact that the president is keyed in on just that is the point to this. He said during during the meeting yesterday that he said regarding the Warner Brothers Discovery folks, none of them are particularly great friends of mine. You know, I want to do what's right. He said, if ever federal regulators approve the deal with Netflix, channels like CNN and TNT would become part of a separate public company, which, I mean, that obviously makes more sense. But I understand what you were saying, of course, regarding Paramount overseeing the Warner Brothers content.
Right. And if the Netflix deal goes forward, then CNN would be spun off on its own or the Discovery channels, all those other ones like TNT. Maybe that's for the best. I mean, I tend to this whole idea of consolidation. The reason consolidations make sense is because they offer some efficiencies in terms of overhead. But what it often brings is high debt, And the loss of creativity and the loss of jobs. So I'd love to see, you know, Ted Turner re-own CNN and, you know, take it as his own and shepherd it through the next generation.
Well, we all know what Trump's motivation is regarding CNN and what, and eventually somebody is going to own CNN, and hopefully it's going to run it as an objective news agency, which is what it started out to be, and which it is largely still like an objective news organization. But Trump is not going to be happy until we get another Fox News or News Nation or whatever the name of the right wing channels are.
You know, I don't think Donald Trump is ever happy with anything. He's not happy with a rate cut. He's not happy with Fox News. He's not, you know.
Well, he wasn't happy with the 60 Minutes. I mean, he has so much to do with that deal, and then with the Marjorie Taylor Greene story over the weekend, was very upset over CNN. I think he felt he had them. I'm sorry, with 60 Minutes, he felt like he had them in his pocket. They did a story he didn't like, and then you're off to the races.
Yeah, he's impossible to please. And so if I was running a network, and I'm not, I mean, I would say, why even try? It's a proven non-starter. But again, they do need that that federal government approval for these deals to take place, because they can be viewed as anti-competitive.
And the fact that David Ellison is going to the White House on Sunday to talk about this, I mean, says so much about these deals and what these deals have become.
And as history shows us, the last person to talk to Donald Trump usually has the greatest sway. So, you know, my money at this point is on the Ellison team upsetting the Netflix deal.
You know, the word consequential usually is considered to be a favorable word. I don't think it has to be. And I think that Trump, we have to begrudgingly say, is the most consequential president in our lifetime. Again, I don't mean consequential to be of positive, but his hands are everywhere. The things he's done and said to break presidential norms are endless. And when he's finally out of Washington, people are going to look back and say, what hit us?
We're out of time. I leave you to go do the Media Project. You can continue on these great topics. We'll be back right after this.